But he got his Coastal Campus Ministry guide converted there in Boulder, Colorado, and has a PhD in chemical physics. Hmm. Chemical physics. And he's a professor. He actually teaches. He's a department chair. And he teaches a pretty heavy load of science, you know, at his university. And, of course, he's on break right now, as all the students are. And here's what he does over his break. He travels around. And he teaches. In the summer, he teaches. He spends his whole time teaching. And so he flew here. He was in Kansas City. He taught there for a day on Saturday and got here and preached on Sunday. And he's here today. He's teaching. He'll be here just till tomorrow. And then we'll take him to St. Louis and he'll fly. And I think we'll get to St. Louis and we'll fly out of the bus.
God will work it out. He always does.
He'll be home for, I don't know, maybe 24, 48 hours. And then he's off to the Philippines where he'll be teaching. There. Wow. And John is going to be gone. He gets back from the Philippines on the 20th, and on the 21st he goes on vacation and he starts teaching science. So he's going to get home, be home a day, and the guy's going to go back to teaching in the classroom. So this literally is how he lives his life. He just goes around and travels all over the world. He is very well known for many. He's written 9 books. 8 of them are published. You can look at, he has some of his books back there. I don't know if you can get them all here today, but you can certainly order them. But the guy is very engaging. He's not maybe like some of those professors, but he is engaging, and I think we're going to learn a lot. So you have an opportunity here. He's going to go over a number of things here. Honestly, I don't know. He'll be helping us to defend the truth. Amen. So I really want to encourage you to give your full attention. Actually, I see his notes here. He's going to start off talking about the existence of God. So, but it's going to be amazing. We're going to start off with a prayer, and then we're going to just have John dive right into it.
Amen.
How about that?
Amen.
Why don't we have, let's have Willie and Katie. You guys want to stand up and lead us in the prayer?
Sure. At the same time, or?
That would be amazing.
Dear Father, thank you so much for today. Thank you so much just that all of us can make it here, Father, and just get to get into your word. I pray that you just speak powerfully through John, and I'm just so grateful for him coming here and just giving his time to us and just helping us learn so much more about you. Father, I'm grateful for the brothers and sisters that can make it, and I pray that this time we can just build closer relationships to each other, Father, and that as we do that, I can kind to your name. We love you so much. In your
son's
holy name I pray. Amen.
God, thank you so much just for bringing us all here. Father, I'm very excited to be here with these amazing students in the Heartland. God, I pray so much that you speak through John. God, provide just some great wisdom and insight for us. I pray that we can take a lot away, open our minds. Father, thank you so much once again just for the opportunity to be here. And it's so encouraging to see what you've done in the Heartland. What you continue to do. We love you so much. In your son's name we pray.
Amen. Is that Willie O'Quinn?
Yeah.
All doubt was removed as soon as he started praying because he sounds exactly like his father. His mom and dad discipled my wife and I 20-something years ago.
Wow.
That was a while ago. We were in Kansas City. They're in Texas somewhere now, I guess. Cool. All right, great. Well, I'm glad to be here. Almost didn't get here, but then that's true of a few of you as well. I got to the airport and they said, your flight's late, we're going to miss your connection, the plane's going to leave, everything's full, everything's down, no flights for at least 2 days. And she said, we're going to take your bags off the plane. I said to her, no, don't take my bags off the plane, I'm going to get there. She said, no, you're not. And I said, yes, I am. And I turns out I was right. Okay, now the way this is going to work is I'm seeing this, you're seeing that, and I have to hit this and that at the same time. So occasionally we're going to get up. See, that didn't. Mm-hmm, okay, here we go. Oh no.
Oh man. Is that on?
Come on,
Henry.
It's on. Uh oh. It worked a minute ago. That computer is a little funky.
Yeah.
all right. Doesn't matter. All right. It was working a couple minutes ago. Sorry about that, folks. Technological difficulties.
Try it now.
I'm trying it.
Well, we'll get it figured out.
That's not a problem. That computer's working. All right. Why don't you take this so you can play with it. You'll know when it's working. Okay, good. So I was asked to do basically a class on Christian evidences, okay? And so that's what I'm going to do. The outline that should be on the screen back then. What I'm going to do is first I'm going to talk about the existence of God. Then I'm going to talk about Jesus, evidence that Jesus is who he said he is. Then I'm going to talk about evidence for the inspiration of the Bible and the reliability of the Bible. Then I'm going to do some on history, archaeology in the Bible. Then I'm going to be doing a section on science and Christianity. And then I'll do a section on the Christian worldview and comparison of Christian worldview to other worldviews. And then defense of Christian theology. So I'll talk about the question of pain and suffering and why is there hell and these kinds of things, those hard questions. Okay, so that's kind of the general outline. Now, one good question is, why would you want to study Christian evidences? Because you could read Hebrews 11:1 and it says, faith is belief in things you can't see. Now, evidence, by definition, is something you can see, right? And if you can see it, then that's not faith. And some people would say, therefore, don't study Christian evidences. Well, I think half of that argument is valid, in a sense, because something you believe because of the evidence is, by definition, not faith. All right, so then why would you want to look at a bunch of evidence? Well, the way I see it is, if all you're doing is looking at some evidence so you can say, ha, 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 I'm right and you're wrong, then, you know, that's not a useful exercise. But if through these next couple of days your faith can be increased and through using these materials you can help other people's faith to increase, then maybe they could go out and act on that faith. Amen. So if we're just here having an intellectual exercise, might as well just go home. All right, but if you're willing to live a more faithful life, then maybe what we can do is we can deepen the evidence that supports that faith, and that faith can become stronger. Then maybe you can do something with it. That would be my argument against those who say Christian evidences aren't important. Now, there's two broad categories of evidence for Christianity. One would be those kinds of evidence that we would use to defend the faith. So some people would say, oh, Christianity is bogus for this, that, and the other reason, and you shouldn't believe it, you're an idiot, and obviously any intelligent person wouldn't be a Christian, and you've heard all these kind of things, you're up on campus, you know about that. So there'd be aspects of Christian evidence that could hopefully be used to answer those questions. You know 1 Peter 3, it says, always be prepared to give an answer to anybody who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. And so there'll be about 60% of what I'm going to be talking about the next couple of days would be in that category. For example, we'll look at history and archaeology. I don't think somebody's going to become a Christian because they saw this really cool, you know, thing, you know, the Tel Dan inscription. They see the Tel Dan inscription and go, I need to give my life to Jesus. You know what I'm saying? So history and archaeology, the use of that is primarily to defend the faith so that to help those who probably are already believers to be defend against the attacks of those who people say, oh, the Bible, you know, there was no such person as David. They never were in Egypt. That's just a bunch of stories they made up. So that'd be an example. Another example of things that can defend the faith would be, we'll talk about how we got the Bible. So we'll talk about the manuscripts and the documents and all that kind of stuff. And again, seeing the Rylands Papyrus or seeing one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, I don't think anybody's going to say, man, I've got to give my life to Jesus because of the Dead Sea Scroll. You know what I'm saying? So I wouldn't be using those in my evangelism so much, but those would be used, hopefully, in your campus ministries to help support the faith. Because you know the brothers and sisters in these campus ministries, they're getting all kinds of junk thrown at them, right? Can I say crap thrown at them? Can I say that? Can you say that now? You can say that with the younger generation. You can't say that with the older generation.
Right.
They think that's a swear word. I don't know. But I can say that in this group. All right, I can say that. Because you're going to get all that stuff. You know what I'm saying? That stuff. And also, I guess about science in the Bible. Generally, well, I'll talk about science and Christianity. This is more defending against those who would say that, you know, obviously scientists wouldn't believe in Christianity. And then I'll also have a section on explaining why supposed contradictions in the Bible are not valid. Okay, so that'd be one half. The other half would be the part of Christian evidence that I'm personally a little bit more excited about, because these are the ones that we can use as a sword as opposed to the shield. First half, shield. Second half, sword. And these would be Christian apologetics that can be used to create faith and to get people to say, wow, you know what? I need to become a Christian. And I would say we're going to talk about the Christian worldview. All right. And so describing the Christian worldview in comparison to other worldviews, I believe, is a possible offensive weapon, if you will. Fulfillment of prophecy. Arguments about Jesus, who he said he was, miracles, these kinds of things, claims of Jesus. All right, so those, I'm not going to go in that order. I want you to be kind of more or less aware, is this a kind of Christian evidence that I should take on campus, make a little Bible talk, sit down with somebody, share with them? And I would say, yes, Christian worldview, prophecy, miracles, resurrection, and the claims of Jesus. That you might want to have a little study ready to go. And the others are more like people say, and then you pull out the other ones. That would be just my basic outline. All right, now, I believe that the importance of Christian evidence is increasing over time by comparison. Because, I was in college 35 years ago. I started my undergraduate 39 years ago. And 40 years ago, you could walk up to somebody on campus, especially here in the Midwest, and you could pretty much assume probably that they believed in the Bible more or less. All right, more or less. Maybe more or less than more. But, you know, that basically the Christian worldview more or less was probably their worldview. All right, and so you could say, for example, you could mention Moses, and they would know that that was some guy, I don't know, in Egypt or something like that, you know? Or you could say that guy was an apostle, and they would know that that was somebody who followed Jesus. You know what I'm saying? You can't assume that anymore. I would say, I don't know. You tell me. You're on campus. I am on campus. I'm on campus every day. I teach there. But a lot of students today, to them, you know, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, New Age, atheism, whatever, it's all kind of this mixed up jumble of stuff. And they're just not aware. And so we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
You know, and some people say we're in what's called the post-Christian age. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, I've been in Europe, in places in Europe. If you go up to somebody and say, I believe in Jesus, they look at you like, you're kidding. Seriously? No, we're not that bad in America yet, all right? But I'm telling you, that's where we're headed.
Yeah.
That is where we are headed.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to have to begin to explain not just that the Bible is inspired by God, but we're going to have to begin to explain the fact that truth even exists at all.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Postmodernism and all that kind of stuff. You know, that all roads lead to God, which is the dumbest thing I ever heard of.
Yeah.
That's the stupidest thing. How does that make sense?
Right.
I mean, all roads go to Kansas City?
Right.
You know, is that, you know, but there's people actually believe this garbage.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of work to do. And I think, for example, in Norway, before they study the Bible with somebody, they go through like 8 different Christian evidences studies. That's their evangelism because they have no choice. I remember I was teaching in Stockholm in Sweden, and I made a statement. I was teaching about this class that I'm about to do on the existence of God. And that's where they have to start. But I'm telling you, as time goes by, that's where we're going to have to start. Just trust me. All right, and I remember just saying, you know, something's either true or it's not. You know, you think that's pretty and if somebody does, if two people have 2 different opinions, if one person's right, then the other person's wrong. And this woman almost fell out of her chair. She couldn't breathe afterwards. She was so upset. And their people were like stunned. And even the Christians were struggling with that a little bit. Thank you. Is it working?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Oh, it was, but it's not right now. All right. There you go. So there's our outline. The one that I already showed you. All right. Defense of Christian theology, all that. Why study apologetics? These are the categories. These are some of the ideas. This is why I'm saying that we really need to begin to think about Christian evidences, because these are the kinds of worldviews we're going to have to oppose. Naturalism, postmodernism, whole idea that all roads lead to God. So Acts 17 is a good example of this, where Paul was reaching out to people who had not a clue. And we're going to spend some time there. We're going to do a section. We're going to kind of study out Acts 17 and see how Paul reached out to people who had a completely different worldview than the Christian or Jewish worldview. All right, so what we're going to do now is we're going to talk about the existence of God. I did this class in Manila a few years ago, and it was, I think, 28 hours. And how much time do I have? I have maybe 12 or so. So I'm going to have to cut it pretty short. All right, so I'm going to be occasionally been going fast, but please stop me with questions, and I'll try to make a habit of, at the end of each section, stopping to questions and answers. All right, so we're going to talk about the existence of God. And I think it'd be good for you to be able to prepare to defend the idea that, yes, there is a God. All right, again, like I said, 40 years ago, I would say this study would have been useful for about 2% of people you would have bumped into. I'd say in America today, maybe only 20%. In Europe, 90%. Okay, that's just the way it is. All right, so here's the outline of this study. Atheist arguments against the existence of God. Now, one thing, just to put this in the back of your head. As you're preparing to be able to answer people's questions, you always need to be able to produce their argument. Got that? So if you want to explain to a Muslim why Christianity is better than Islam, you better know what they're going to tell you. Okay? And another thing is, read books by the people with whom you disagree. Now, I don't say that to baby Christians necessarily, because, you know, the baby Christians, they just need to be on that milk, and, you know, they just milk. You know? They may be not ready for solid food, but I'm assuming most of you are out on campus evangelizing, right? It's kind of, that's why you're here, pretty much? Okay, great. So I think we're off baby food now. We're off the milk. You need to learn to be able to understand why the atheist thinks that atheism is correct. You need to understand why the New Ager thinks that, you know, sin is not real. And you need to understand where they're coming from, okay? So the first thing we're going to do is I'm going to sort of present the atheist argument, if you will, why they shouldn't believe in God. Then I'm going to show why that argument basically doesn't work, and then I'll present some of the classic arguments for theism. And by the way, theism is the belief in a God who exists and who interacts. Deism is the belief in a God who exists but who does not interact in the world. There's a lot of deists. In fact, in science, deism is not that unusual, actually. But out there in the world, it's kind of rare. All right. So these are some arguments that say there is no God. First argument is you can't see him. Okay? Oh, that's right. See, I need to remind you of this. We have to keep doing this the whole time. All right, great. All right. So first argument is you can't see him. Second argument is, all the Christians are a bunch of hypocrites. Now, you've heard these arguments, right? You've heard these. The problem of suffering. Which I would say, of all these arguments, is the only one that has even the slightest ounce of validity. And then atheism is the default position, all right? So, I've been around, and best I can tell, these are the only ones I've ever really seen, all right? So we're going to describe these and kind of talk about why perhaps, just maybe, possibly, these may not be super awesome, strong arguments. Okay? All right. Yuri Gagarin. Now, probably most of you don't know who he is. Who's Yuri Gagarin? Yeah, he was the first guy in space. He beat Shepard, Yuri Gagarin. He said, "I went up there and I didn't see him." All right? So what's wrong with that argument? Let's just practice right now. What's wrong with that argument? I went up there and he wasn't there. What's wrong with that argument? Whoever said he was there?
Yeah.
See, a good approach to these people who say, "I don't believe in God because of blah, blah, blah," is to say, "Well, tell me about the God you don't believe in." All right? Old man in the sky, you know. And he said, "Oh, I don't believe in that God either." No wonder you don't believe in God. That's, you know, the God that we believe in exists outside of time and space and is not affected by time and space. All right? And, you know, how could God hear all of our prayers? All right? That's not a question of whether they believe in God. It's a question of whether they believe in the God that we believe in as opposed to some concept of God. That's not even a correct understanding. So part of this is, it's our job is to explain who God is. So how are you going to do that? Well, you can talk about it, but you might possibly want to have some scriptures. For example, what about Hebrews 11:3? That's a great passage. Hebrews 11:3 says, by faith we believe that what is seen was created from things that are unseen. All right, so God is not a physical being. He doesn't have arms and legs and hands. All right, and they say, "Well, I can't believe in something you can't see." And by the way, this is a philosophy. It's called naturalism. It's called scientific materialism. And I deal with this all the time. In the science setting, this is pretty standard operating procedure. They say, "I don't believe in it." How can you believe in something you can't see? All right, well, do you believe in the wind? Have you ever, anybody here ever seen the wind? I haven't. So why do you believe in the wind?
You can feel it.
You see the trees doing this. All right. Now, I suppose you could say the trees are doing that because there's certain, forces within the branches that make them do, you know. There's many possible explanations of the facts. And really, be with me on this. The arguments for the existence of God are, given what we know, by far the best explanation is that there's God. Because you can't prove God. If you could prove God, that's kind of the way God did it. He left us room for unbelief. It's a little frustrating, but he doesn't drop notes out of the sky. He does not have shining lights, you know, like the Batman thing in the sky. You know, I'm here, and unlike that guy who came to church yesterday, but that's a whole other story. Ask Vince later, he'll tell you. Can you see love? What's love anyway? What is it? What is love? The scientists would say it's chemicals being released in your brain. The Bible says God is love. Well, what's that mean? All right, so this argument that you can't see him is not a good argument. All right, now, for some people it works. But that's how I would respond to that argument. Say, has anybody here seen an electron? All right? Has anybody ever seen beauty? There's all kinds of things you can't see. You can't see yourself. You can see your body. This is a good one to throw out with people when you're talking with them. Ask them, do you have a body or are you a body? Just think about that for a minute. Do you have a body or are you a body? Right? That's a good question. And, of course, everybody knows. Now, if you can catch the atheists off guard because their official position is I am a body, but even they know that we're not a body. All right? Because you say, I want to go over there. Well, what's that mean? Because if you are a body, when you say, I want to go over there, that's a nonsense statement. What do you mean, I? What's I? I is, you know, chemicals and that was happening yesterday. What, is that the wind doing that? Or it's like a harmonica or something like that. It was doing that during church yesterday.
Those are
the angels, yeah. All right. So you say, you know, I want to go to the store. What's that mean? If you accept the atheist view, what that means is the neurons in your brain are in a particular state that are releasing chemicals in your brain in a particular way that make you think you want to go to the store. So I guess you want to go to the store. Either that or I exist, independent of my body, and the thing is, everybody understands that, even if they officially don't believe in it, they all understand that. So this idea that God doesn't exist because you can't see him, to me that's a bogus argument. Just, it doesn't really make sense, and I believe all human beings know it doesn't make sense, even if they say it does. All right? Now you may not convince somebody from that argument, but they have something to bear in mind. The next reason is, because of the hypocrisy. How could I believe in Christianity given all the hypocrites? All right, now, we've heard that one before. But there's more subtle versions of this, maybe not subtle at all. You know, given the Crusades and what these Christians did and these terrible stuff, what about the Spanish Inquisition? What about the abuse that's going on with the priests there in the Catholic Church? Obviously, Christianity is not real. Look at what Christians are doing. You know, at first, okay. I hit the forward button and it just didn't go forward. That's why. Okay. Oh, tech guy.
We're with you.
I think we're going to have to switch out to use my computer because my computer will. And we can use yours up here and we can use mine back there. Okay. There we go. It went forward. Good. That went two slides, actually. No? All right, good. So, and again, as an emotional argument, this is a pretty good argument. All right? The argument that, well, you know, Christians, they'll say practically all the evil ever done in the world was done by religious people. Yeah, that's because 99.9% of people ever were religious, so naturally, 0.01% probably of the people couldn't have done all the, you know what I'm saying? But really, if you think about it, that's really a silly argument. It really is a silly argument. Because let's talk about Jesus. And I don't care who they are, if they know the slightest amount about Jesus, if you ask anybody, would Jesus have approved of the Crusades? All right, so have people who claim to be Christians done terrible things? I'll concede that one. That doesn't affect whether Christianity is true or not. Have atheists ever done evil things? Of course they have. So does that mean atheism is... This isn't even an argument. Seriously, folks, this isn't even an argument. So I think we need to bust that one. All right, if you're not going to go to church because of all the hypocrites, then you can't go to the movies, you can't go to the store, you can't leave your house. In fact, you can't even live in your own bedroom where you're the only person there because you're a hypocrite too. All right, that's just a smokescreen. That's all it is, and we need to label it as that.
Yeah.
The question is not whether some people claim to be Christians have done evil things. The question is whether God is real or not. And what does this argument have to do with the question of whether God's real or not? It has absolutely nothing to do with it. That's just a smokescreen. Okay? So I think we should probably mention that. And again, we had a debate a few years ago. We set up a debate between Shmuley Batech, He's the Shalom for the Home guy, and the most famous Jew today. Him and Shabir Ali, who's a Muslim imam, the most famous apologist for Islam today. And Doug, we set up this debate. And it was interesting. Both Shmuley and Shabir Ali agree that one of their biggest arguments against Christianity is that Jesus was a pacifist. So even the Muslims know that Jesus was a much better guy than their guy. And we won't mention some of the stuff that Muhammad did and massacring 700 Jews and, never mind, we won't go there. All right, good. So that's that argument. Now the problem of suffering. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to delay this question about the problem of suffering. I'm going to go into that in more detail. I'm going to give you the 3-second version here. But of the 4 arguments for atheism I'm presenting here, and these are the only 4 I've actually seen that even, I don't know, what can I say? This is the only one that I think it at least deserves a response. It's a reasonable argument. The first argument was nonsense. Second argument, nonsense. This argument, I don't think it's fair to call it nonsense. The argument would be something like this. You believe in a God who's all-powerful. You believe in a God who's so loving that love is defined by him. All right? A baby dies of cancer at 2 months, or the typhoon wipes out 5,000 people in the Philippines, and you have genocide in Rwanda and South Sudan. Help me out here. It's either because God can't stop it, or it's because he doesn't care. Pick. I'm going to admit, that argument, that gets some traction.
Yeah.
And if you just say, whatever, blah, I don't think so. We have to talk a little bit about that. All right. And I'm purposely not taking that one on right now because that's near the end of our thing. We'll talk about answering the hard questions. But this is a hard question. Yeah. And I'll just tell you right now, it's not an easy question. It's not answered easily. I'll give you the 10-second version. Suffering is due to natural causes and evil.
Yeah.
And where does evil come from? Well, that's a really good question. Let me kind of go off into that a little bit. One of the strongest arguments for Christianity and for the existence of God is the existence of evil.
Yeah.
That might sound bizarre and hard to believe, but I believe it's true. Because if you don't believe in God, then you don't believe in evil.
Yeah.
And if you don't believe in evil, then you're going to have to stop looking around. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But that's a Christian worldview argument, so I'm not going to go there right now. I am going to talk about the moral argument later on as a positive defense of the existence of God. So I'm going to not have answered this question very thoroughly, to be honest with you, but I'm going to go on to the next slide. All right, I keep doing this. There we go. Yes, if God is omniscient, omnipotent, and loving and compassionate, then in view of suffering, that God, the God that Christians believe in, certainly cannot exist. And like I said, I believe this is a reasonable argument. The other ones are not reasonable. I believe this is not a correct argument, but I believe it's a reasonable argument. And again, like I said, I believe I'm going to show that the Christian answer to this question about suffering and evil is the only one that makes sense. Okay? And then this argument is based on false premises. What I mean by that is, it's assuming that suffering is bad and that suffering is evil. It's assuming that death is bad and death is evil. Now, if you're an atheist, when you're dead like Rover, dead all over, then I guess maybe that works. But that's making an assumption and a false one. So we have to be careful about assumptions. All right? Assumes that a loving God, omniscient, omnipotent, ought to prevent all suffering. We'll talk about free will, talk about natural causes, but I'm going to go on to the next thing. All right. The last one is a lack of belief in God is the default position. Now, we arranged a debate several years ago, actually 2 different debates between Michael Shermer, who's probably the most well-known American atheist. We got those Brit guys over there. Dawkins and that other guy I don't even like to talk about. He did die, so anyway, so it's It's not nice to talk about people who died, so I'll leave it at that. But anyway, so Michael Shermer did a debate with Jacoby. The way we arranged that, that's quite a story. Here we are in our living room in my friend's house. We want to do a debate. And somebody said, well, let's get Michael Shermer. And we all started laughing. And then 6 months later, we had him to do a debate with Doug. And this was his argument. This is the most well-known skeptic / agnostic / atheist in America today. This was his argument. And I've got a copy of the debate back there. You can listen to it for yourself. And basically, his argument was, unless you can prove to me that God exists, then I'm going to assume that he doesn't exist. Now, that's a pretty weak argument. But he's smart enough to know that's the only argument that actually works. And he threw out a bunch of rhetoric and one-liners saying, yeah, you know, the God you believe in, you know, he decides who goes to heaven, he decides go to... And he was arguing against brands of Christianity that aren't even true. But this was his only argument. And I would say, who decided that unless you've proved beyond a reasonable doubt that God... By the way, you can, but that's beside the point. What arbiter said that the God doesn't exist is the default backup position? Yeah. Where did that come from? I mean, the facts of the matter are that 90-something percent of all people who've ever lived, including the smart ones, all right, including the well-educated ones, have believed that God exists. So what you're saying is 2% of all people who've ever lived, their opinion is right unless you can prove that they're not right, okay? I don't know about you, but that doesn't work to me as a very strong argument. Especially, that's why in this debate, Michael Shermer got toasted. And the reason he got toasted is he had no response to the arguments that Doug presented and that I'm going to present. The evidence for God is so overwhelming that you go back to Romans 1 and it says, those who don't believe in God, they have to force themselves to not believe in God. Mm-hmm. All right. So, and I'll make that point a few other times during this couple of days here. All right. So, why atheism fails? It's based on circular reasoning. I mean, the bottom line is, if you analyze these arguments these atheists make, almost always the arguments start by assuming there's no God. Okay. Now, have Christians ever used circular reasoning to defend their faith? Oh, man, I'll tell you, man. But, you know, if you want to learn how not to argue for your faith, talk to some non-believers and get them to explain, and they'll give you the perfect lesson on how not to do it. All right, but unfortunately, Christians have done this. Number two, atheism cannot answer the hard questions. That's a worldview issue, and I may get back to that later on. So belief in that there is no God, there's no evidence there's no God. There's literally no evidence there's no God. There's none like that. So the only way you can reach that conclusion is by assuming it's not true, then you kind of go through this and then this and then this and this, and therefore there's no God. All right, but those kinds of arguments, circular reasoning, is not very strong. Atheism cannot answer the hard questions, and besides, it's a bankrupt philosophy. I'll put it this way. If atheism is true, then I think I just won't believe in it anyway, you know? Or just kill yourself. All right? It's terrible philosophy. I guess that's not a big argument against it, but if it's true, then it's very depressing. At the very least, it's very depressing. All right, let's see here. Circular reasoning. Now, you could say to the believer that there is no such thing as the supernatural or transcendent reality. Well, first of all, you'd have to be a transcendent being to even know if there is no transcendent reality. So, you know, how do you know that? And I've heard people try to say, from science we know that there is no supernatural. That is totally circular reasoning. Completely circular reasoning, and hopefully we can inform people of that. All right? Now, so basically you're saying the natural laws that exist prove that there are no supernaturals. How does that doesn't make sense. Because all science can do is say, here is what happens naturally. That's what science is. Science describes what happens naturally. In fact, that's all that science can describe. And if supernatural things happened, by definition, science wouldn't even be able to explain them or talk about them. That's just outside of their whole realm of knowledge. All right? So people who say that there's no supernatural, what they're really saying is, I don't believe in the supernatural. Therefore, there's no supernatural. Well, so much for that argument. Can you give me an actual argument instead of one like that? Or they'll say there's no absolute truth. This is the postmodern argument. There's no absolute truth. Yeah, everything's relative. There's no absolute truth. Are you absolutely sure about that? All right. If this is the strongest argument for the non-existence of God, it's a pretty weak one. All right, good. Now, I was watching a BBC broadcast not so long ago, and they got this arrogant chemist guy up there, and he was like, it wasn't exactly a debate. What it was is they had a theist and an atheist, and they kind of put them on trial, sort of, basically, in this BBC setting. And the theist, of course, presented a very reasonable argument. But then the atheist guy got up there. He happened to be a chemist. And he says, the only things that are real are things that can be seen and measured. He made that statement. Okay. Well, that's great. That's materialism. That's atheism. Okay, great. And then the panel asked him, well, why do you believe that? You would think he would have an answer for that question. You would think, since he bases his entire philosophy on this. He says, man, all those Christians that blah, 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 and the Muslims and these radical thing, blah, and the Crusades. And they said, excuse me, we asked you a question. Would you please answer the question? You said the only thing that is real is things that can be seen and measured. That's the materialist philosophy. And we asked you a simple question. How do you know that? And went blah blah blah, but, you know, and these other religions, you know, these and other, just, you know, people believe in fairies. And they said, excuse me, sir, we're not going to go on to the next question until you answer the first question, which is, how do you know there is no supernatural? He said, I guess I just believe it.
Is that William Craig?
Hmm?
Is that William Craig?
No, William Lane Craig, he's a believer. He that definitely would be that guy. I don't think he was the one on the other side. I don't think so. I'm pretty sure it was a British guy. All right? So in other words, his strongest argument that there's no God is because he believes there's no God. Wow. If you're going to base your whole life on that, all right? So what in the final analysis, these people who claim there's no God because of X, Y, and Z, you need to understand, and a lot of us, I think a lot of believers kind of get intimidated by these people, and these smart people. I'm saying, guys, don't be intimidated by these people. Their arguments are very, very weak. All right. Now, I teach a philosophy of science class, and these are some of the questions that science can answer and that atheist philosophy can answer. When, what, where, how many, by what means? In fact, I would claim that science answers this set of questions better than any other approach yet devised by people. It's awesome. In fact, if you want to answer when, where, what, and how many using the Bible, it may not even be the first place to go in certain cases. Perhaps. I'll just throw that out there for consideration anyway. All right, science does a great job at answering these questions. Now, I want to ask you a question. Do these get you going in the morning? Is this something you can live for? Do you really care? I mean, seriously, in terms of, you know, whether life is even worth living at all, and when does that really do it for you? Okay, it doesn't do it much for me. In fact, it does basically nothing for me. All right, now here are some questions that science is absolutely, completely incapable of even beginning to approach answering. These are the only questions people actually care about. Right? Why am I here? Why am I here? Well, if science can't answer that question, the reason you're here is just a total, absolute accident. Well, that really gives me a sense of value. And now, I guess if it was true, then okay, I guess so. But, gee. Let me see. Is that the right thing to do? Because if you don't believe in God, then the question, is that the right thing to do? That's actually a nonsense question. What do you mean the right thing? There's no such thing as the right thing to do. There's just things to do. Right? There's just things to do. Now, I don't know about you, but I would not want to live in a world where that was the principal philosophy. There's just things to do. And they're all as good as all the other things. You know? Rape is just one of the things. Lying is just, that's one of the options. Why not lie? I mean, give me a possible reason not lie. You know? In fact, I would argue that it's actually a pretty good thing to do. How about the question of purpose? Why am I here? What's my purpose? Well, if we accept materialism, if we accept there's no God, then what is your purpose? I guess to make more copies of your DNA. Okay? And that, in fact, the more copies of your DNA you make, you know, the better you are. So why not rape and kill and destroy the environment? Why not? I mean, as long as you make more copies of yourself. I mean, where does atheism leave us? Okay, what about the question of value? What about the question of value? How valuable am I? Well, if I take the atheist perspective here, I don't know, maybe $3.25. I mean, there's some calcium, a little bit of magnesium, got some carbon, well, that's not worth much. I don't know, there's a little bit of sodium, you know. I mean, science and atheism, that doesn't answer the question about value. In fact, value is, what's that mean? Now, Christianity provides a slightly different answer to the question, how valuable are you? You're worth more than the whole world. All right, you're worth God giving his son. So to me, that's a little bit better answer. Do supernatural events occur? Why is there evil and suffering in the world? Science, atheism says, there just is. You know, that's why. There's no reason. It just is. All right, so to me, atheism doesn't answer the questions that matter to me. Let me see. If atheism is right, then I don't exist. You know, when you say to your spouse or whoever, you know, I love you, you might as well just say, I chemical you, I neurotransmitter you. Right now, neurotransmitters are being released in my brain that are making my, you know, my parasympathetic nervous system be activated. All right. I don't know. Kind of, I prefer, I love you. Okay. If there's right, there's no soul. And again, if there's no God, then you don't exist. Let me make that plain to you. And I think we need to spread this information out to our non-believers. If atheism is right, then you don't exist. Okay, do you understand what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
If atheism is right, then you don't exist. Your body exists, but, you know, when you say, I fill in the blank, we should just take that word out of our grammar. You know, I am an accountant. What do you mean, you? What are you talking about? You? Who's you? You're a bag of chemicals because of random signals that go through the brain, but not totally random because of something that happened to you when you're 5 years old. This sack of chemicals put your brain into the condition that it makes you think that you're an accountant. You know, atheism is empty. It's horrible, and it's also not true. Because if atheism is right, then life has no value, no purpose. Love is chemicals moving around in your brain. Man, people actually go for this stuff. Now, does atheism work? Now, again, we can concede that evil has been done in the name of religion. Now, I think this is a bit overblown, to be honest with you. I think most wars have not been over religion. That was just the excuse. It's been over greed and all other stuff. But To completely dismiss this idea is probably not reasonable. Let's face it. Okay? But atheism's been tried. You know, you just kind of scan all history and think, has this social experiment been done? Where people said, let's set up an entire system based on the premise that there is no God. Yeah, it's been tried. They tried it in France back in the late 1700s. That was a great experiment. Pol Pot, you know, Cambodia, that experiment, that really, that, you know, if these are scientists and say we're going to learn by doing experiments, we've done this experiment. Red China, you know, Soviet Russia. Boy, these are really great examples of how atheism as a philosophy produces awesome results. Okay? So if our society is going to go in the direction we accept there's no God, then I don't know. I think I'm going to go to Greenland or something. I don't know. All right, so that was all kind of depressing. So we're going to spend not a lot of time. We're going to try to break it up into short pieces. We're going to try to go through these arguments pretty quickly. We'll open up for question and answer. So these are some arguments for the existence of God. All right? And you can take those. That's so awesome. I'm glad you are. But all these PowerPoints are at my website anyway. Or I'll re-present them or leave them here. You can send around copies of all of them. The moral argument, cosmological, teleological, ontological, etc. So these are some arguments for the existence of God. Okay, now, so I'm going to go through these. So that was too quick. If you're taking notes, you didn't get them down anyway. All right, now, we have a math major here. You have a math major here? And the point of this thing here, those are partial differential equations. Is that an ODE or a PDE? It's a PDE, all right? Just, we'll take its word for it. The point of this slide is, let me just put it out there right now. You cannot prove that God exists. Okay? Can't do it. You can prove that the sides of an equilateral, the angles of an equilateral triangle are equal. You can prove that, but you cannot prove that God exists. Okay? All you can really do is you can say, here's reality. Here's two explanations. One, explain reality, no God. Explain reality with God. And the fact is, reality being explained that there is God, that's the only rational explanation. Okay? And so you can't prove the existence of God. So that's not our job to prove that God exists. Our job is to show that if you don't believe God exists, you're ignoring the obvious facts. Right? You got some explaining to do. You got some explaining to do around here. Where's that come from? Explaining. Some show. Got some splaining to do. Ricky and Lucy. Got some splaining to do around here. All right, so, and you know, to me, part of the reason for this is I believe, I'm thinking theologically here, that is God does not force us to believe in Him. Free will is real. God leaves us room to not believe. If you want to not believe, there's enough out there that you could kind of hang on to. If you really want to not believe, there's just enough out there that if you want to hang on to it, I guess you can go with that. All right, so like I said, God doesn't drop nopes out of the sky. He doesn't, you know, you're having a thought, gee, I wonder if God exists, and He blasts you, and you don't think, oh, I'm going to, you know, lust right now, and suddenly, I don't know, you know, bolts of lightning. You know, it doesn't work that way. So God leaves room for unbelief, and if you don't like that, then I guess you don't like the God that we have to deal with, which is the one who gave us a choice. And the choice is either real or it's not real, and apparently it's real. All right, so you can't prove that God exists, but there are several arguments. What about the moral argument? All right, and again, these are just arguments, and I'll have to say, I'm presenting arguments for the existence of God. I would say less than 2% of the people you meet would be influenced by these arguments. I'm just being straight with you, okay? Simply you living the Christian life is a much more powerful argument than these for most people. Remember I said there's different kinds of apologetics? There's one where you're defending belief. And this is the defensive one, okay? This is so that our Christians are able to answer these people, all right? And there's a tiny, tiny fraction who would actually become a Christian because of one of these arguments. I don't want to give you false advertising here, okay? Got it? And really, all you're doing with this for some people is just catching their attention. Getting to realize, wow, maybe another perspective, maybe I should at least think about another perspective. Maybe even come to church. That's what did it for me. I just went to church. I go, wow. Wow. Gee, I think I better study the Bible. That's what it did for me. I'm a scientist. I was in a PhD program. That's what it was for me. All right. Do moral absolutes exist? Of course, the atheist says no. The theist says yes. So, simple question. Is it wrong for somebody to rape a young child? I'm not getting a lot of answers out there. You know, because the atheist says it is not wrong to rape a young child. They might say it's inadvisable. They might say it's not ethical. Now, don't be confused by ethics. Ethics is not morality. Morality is this is right and this is wrong. Ethics is that wouldn't be a good idea. All right. In other words, ethics is if you do this, this will be the consequences, and the negative results of this are bigger than the positive results of this. Therefore, not you shouldn't do it because shouldn't has nothing. Therefore, it's better not to do it than it is to do it. And that's all an atheist can have is ethics, but not morality, because morality, the very idea of morality is completely unacceptable if there's no God. Okay? So the moral argument, I believe, is a strong one. So here's the premise. Absolute moral laws exist. And what's the opposite of that? What's the opposite of absolute moral laws exist? They don't exist. So that would be the other argument. Okay? You could make that argument. Absolute moral laws exist. Such laws must be promulgated by an authority. If there are things that are true, capital T, not little t, capital T, true, then they have to be true for some, you know, based on something. So therefore, the authority that creates these absolutes of right and wrong is by definition God. Now, I know for most of you, you'd be like, oh, all right, that would not, for most of us, we're not totally intellectually oriented, that would not be the reason we're a Christian today, okay? But I'm telling you, argument is hard to get around unless you're going to say some things are true that in your heart you know aren't true. And you talk to an atheist, they say, man, that ain't right. Oh, I thought you were an atheist. You know, you shouldn't share your faith. Excuse me. I thought you were an atheist. You know? So you do believe in moral absolutes. They shouldn't teach, you know, creationism in schools, which I agree with, but never mind that. If this argument is false, then justice is meaningless. I'm telling you. If the atheist is right, then justice is a word that has absolutely no meaning. Because justice, that basically, when you say we need to have justice here, what you mean is we need to have the right thing happen. That is wrong. So what is the basis for truth? The atheist says there is none. Again, does this prove God exists? I would just say this is a very strong argument for the existence of God. Because if there's no God, then there's no right and wrong. Okay? And I'm just telling you, even atheists don't actually believe what they say they believe. Just talk to them. Just listen to them talking, and within a few minutes you realize they do believe in the moral argument. They just don't admit it. Okay, that's one, the moral argument. That moral absolute exists implies the source of this moral argument, which is, by definition, God. Do the words good, evil, right, and wrong have any objective meaning? And I'm telling you, even atheists use those words all the time. All right. If so, then there must be a metaphysical authority. That alternative is naturalism and postmodernism, both of which I've been explaining already. It won't work. Next is the cosmological argument. Again, like I said, most of you, this is not going to yank your chain. It's not going to really get you going. But I'm telling you that those who do not believe in God have to basically dismiss these arguments. And again, all right, for your Christians who hear these people, you know, they're on campus, they're taking science classes from atheists, they're taking economics classes from atheists, they're taking religion classes from atheists. I think we need to, you know, arm them with some of these things. And to realize, when they're hearing somebody say this, they're going to translate it to what they're really saying, which is nonsense. Or either that, or at the very best, a very, very weak argument. Okay, everything which exists has a cause. All right, can you think of any exceptions? All right, I'm looking at the beam that's there, right there. I mean, that's there, but it's because it was put there. So, you know, everything that happens has a cause. The universe itself exists. Anybody going to argue with that one? By the way, these are classic arguments, deductive type arguments. And so it's all based on the premise. You have to look at the premise and argue the premise, but we're not going to do that. Right? We're not going to get into all this, you know, argument over the premises. These are a set of premises. The universe was caused to exist, therefore there's God. And really there's two choices. Either the universe has always existed, in which case perhaps maybe it wasn't caused, or it hasn't always existed. But which is actually the case, according to scientists, anyway. Has not always existed. So therefore, it began to exist. In fact, that's the Kalam cosmological argument, which is a stronger one, created by your buddy there. What's his name? William Lane Craig, yeah. The Kalam cosmological argument. Everything which begins to exist has a cause. Now, that's even a stronger premise, in my opinion. If something did not exist and then it exists, then clearly the reason it came into existence is because it was caused to come into existence. Like I said, I understand that many of you out there are like, oh, thank you very much for this argument. It's not going to, you know, help you in your relationship with God. But anyway, therefore the universe was caused, that causes God. Okay, that the universe began to exist has been proved. And, you know, for philosophers and scientists, I'm telling you, I co-taught this class, Intro to Scientific Thought, with this guy, this in-your-face atheist guy, total atheist guy. And I presented some of these things in our class, or co-teaching, and after about 6 semesters teaching together, he came up to me one day, he said, John, guess what? There's a creator! I said, no kidding! No kidding! He kind of, it finally hit him one day. Through these kinds of arguments. This guy was in your face, total. In fact, I brought him to one of Lane Craig's debates. That was kind of fun. That was before he'd kind of come around. Anyway. So that's cool. Alright, next is the teleological argument. To me, this is the most convincing of the three. Some people would say the moral argument is the most convincing. It depends on who you're talking to. Probably to the average person, the moral argument is the strongest, I would say. But to people like me, who think more analytically, to me, this is the strongest. So the teleological argument says there's clear evidence of design. In other words, reality says, design. And design implies, obviously, designer. All right, and so that's the classic watchmaker argument. All right, so you're walking down the street, and you see a watch. We should probably say a smartphone instead. We'll say a smartphone. I'll kind of update it. You see a smartphone, and you're thinking, gee, how did that get there? I know what it was. There was some petrochemicals and some metal and some, you know, other things, and the cars went over it, and the weather, and, you know, and then... And then, you know, some lightning, boom, smartphone. Right, exactly. Now, which has more intricate moving parts in it, a smartphone or the simplest bacteria in the universe? That's easy. I mean, that's easy, you know. And what level of complexity says design? And the point of this argument is the universe itself, I mean, which has more evidence for design, a smartphone or the universe and life in the universe? That's an easy question. So if you don't believe in God, you have to believe that all this stuff is an absolute series of utter accidents with no purpose behind them at all. To me, that's a pretty strong argument for God. I don't know. I don't know about you. It works pretty well for me. Now, what I'm going to do is, I think I'm going to skip through these things because I'm going to come back to this teleological argument when I talk about science and Christianity. So I'm purposely laying this aside. I'm going to even skip through some slides. It's going to be so tempting to stop right now and go through these things, the fine-tuned universe and the gravity, all this stuff. Yeah, but I'm going to skip it all for now, even though it's tempting, because I'm going to talk about science and Christianity, and I'll come back to it at that point. Okay? Okay, good. So I'll skip all that. And I'm basically done. Ontological arguments never done anything for me, so I'll just skip it altogether. One of the guys, we have this organization, Apologetic Research Society, and this guy, Brian Cologne, the ontological argument, that's the best argument. I kind of go, okay, you know, there it is. Oh, let's read it. I mean, you know, why not? You're probably going to agree with me. This is like, you're kidding. Every known human desire. Sorry, this is the argument. Good, we skipped it. It's too late. It's gone. All right. The argument from desire. C.S. Lewis argument. I'm going to skip that. That's a pretty good one. Argument from changed lives. All right. This is a pretty strong argument. You know, and the argument from experience. Now, I'm a scientist. And as a scientist, I'm uncomfortable with arguing from experience. My friend, who I met yesterday, he had this experience, you know. And I'm like, okay, that's an experience. There's many different ways to interpret that experience. And personally, your interpretation, I don't know if I even agree with that interpretation. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, the fact that our lives here in the church were changed by God, I don't know. That argues for God to me. I think that one kind of bites, not the bad kind of bite. It grabs on. It bites. You can quote me on that one. That argument bites. Okay. I don't know. The fact that, you know, just so many people who believe in God have had their life changed. Again, experiential arguments. I'm a scientist. I'm a little bit skeptical of those, and because there's going to be, you know, Hindus whose life were changed by belief in Brahman. But nevertheless, I don't know. I think it's a valid argument. Change lives, marriages saved, lives live with purpose and meaning. I don't know. To me, that's a valid argument. And here's my last one. And this is the one they normally don't even list in these books about arguments for the existence of God. This one would be my second favorite one. Oh, okay. Oh! It was there? Ah, there you go. So, to me, the two strongest arguments for the existence of God are the design argument and the inspiration of the Bible. I mean, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about the inspiration of the Bible. And, I don't know, I read the book of Daniel, and I look at the messianic prophecies, and in fact, well, after a while, how about that lesson yesterday? I mean, if you were here, if you could explain that without God, then help me out. Help me out. I'm serious. And again, for the atheist, probably you don't want to start here in just sort of a basic argument, because they don't know anything about the Bible and they don't accept the idea of authority. And so with the blatant atheist, you may not start here, but I'd go here really quickly, you know? Get him reading the book of John and the claims of Jesus, and that's just some reasonable questions. Even the total atheist guys think Jesus was a good guy, at least. All right? And he said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. All right? Well, help me out here. If he's a good guy and he's saying that, how's that work? You know what I'm saying? So I would say arguments for the inspiration of the Bible are pretty good ones. Now, like I said, I'm going to try to break this up into fairly small chunks. I think I talked for, you know, about an hour. So let's take some questions and answer, and then we'll take a break. Any questions?
What do you mean by circular reasoning?
Yeah. Basically, any argument where the first premise is the thing you're trying to prove. All right? For example, in this guy in the BBC, he was trying to, in quotes, prove that there's no supernatural. But if you analyze any argument I've ever seen against the supernatural, if you look at it, what you realize is they assumed that it wasn't true as a premise of the argument. All right? So, for example, if you, you're trying to prove that this guy is Greek, you know, and you start by saying, well, you know, he's Greek, and therefore he likes pizza, and, you know, and then you go through a series of arguments, and then you say, therefore he's Greek. All right? And so the arguments, other than it's the default argument, which is basically not an argument at all, other arguments that there is no God come down to, for example, a lot of people, they're dealing with the Old Testament. They're saying that, for example, they'll say that Judaism arose from polytheism. I've heard that argument. And from an anthropological viewpoint, that makes sense. And I'll agree with that. And yet, when they analyze Judaism and say that it evolved from polytheism, if you look at their arguments, they assume that all religions evolve from polytheism, and that's really their argument.
Yeah.
Well, that's not an argument, mm-hmm. or a circular reasoning. So a lot of people who try to prove that the Bible's got a bogus history, it's not true, what it comes down to is, first of all, they assume the Bible's not inspired by God. And the way they prove the Bible's not inspired by God is by assuming that it's not inspired by God. And so what they'll do is say, you can't use the Bible to prove the Bible. Well, if you've ever heard that, you can't use the Bible to prove the Bible, what they're actually doing subtly, you may not be able to detect it, they're using circular reasoning. They're trying to argue a point by assuming the point. Now, Christians throughout the years have been guilty of circular arguments, okay? And maybe some of you are not going to worry about it. That's just not your thing anyway. You're not going to worry about it. But if you want to have discussions with people who are smart, you might want to avoid some of these circular arguments. For example, there's a sense in which proving the Bible is true by assuming it's true. For example, how do you know the Bible is inspired by God? Let's go to 2 Timothy 3:16. If you go to 2 Timothy 3:16 to prove the Bible is inspired by God, that would be circular reasoning. Okay? The one scripture that's useless to say whether the Bible is inspired by God is 2 Timothy 3:16. That's the conclusion. That's certainly not a premise. Okay, good. Any other questions? I've heard that one used, by the way. They're trying to prove the Bible is inspired by God. They go to 2 Timothy 3:16. I kind of go, oh, man. Oh, go ahead.
I just had a question. I don't know. You don't have to answer it now if you're going to get to it later somehow. But I'm studying with a Muslim, and he has a lot of questions about the Trinity.
Yeah. Yeah, if I was having a discussion with a Muslim, and I was in the Middle East this summer, and so I got to talk to a number of people like that, and that's a tough one to deal with, to be honest with you, because the bottom line is the Trinity is not logical.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It doesn't really make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, proving the Christian concept of the Trinity through engaging in a, you know, premise-based argument with a Muslim is I'll be honest with you, I tend to want to change the subject.
Yeah.
Not that I don't believe in the Trinity, don't get me wrong. But let's break down John 1:1.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning was the Word.
The Word
was with God, and the Word was God. All right? That's problematic. All right? So my proof that Jesus is God is to read the Gospel of John. It's not to argue that God has to be tritheistic or something like that. So some people try to go to, I don't know, Genesis 1, and the Spirit was hovering over the water. See, that's the Holy Spirit. I'm trying to think of myself as a Muslim and think, okay. So my response to that is, let's spend some time looking at Jesus. You know, you believe that Jesus wasn't crucified. You believe that he's kind of in the same general. There's Jesus and Muhammad and Moses. You're saying that Jesus is a prophet like any other. Let's go to Psalm 22. Let's go to Isaiah 53. Let's go to John 14:6. Let's go to John 11. Etc. So I would try to have them look at Jesus. But I would say, from a purely logical perspective, it's hard to defend the Trinity.
Yeah. I guess his main argument is, he says, a whole is perfect by definition. And so, if Jesus is part of a whole, so if he's part of God, then how can it be?
But he's not part of a whole.
Yeah.
But that's not logical. So, like I said, if you want to engage in a purely logic-based argument over the Trinity with a Muslim, I'm not sure you're going to win that argument. Yeah. Again, that doesn't mean that Muhammad's a prophet, because he wasn't a prophet. He was a child molester and murderer and a lot of other things. Do not bring that up in a discussion with a Muslim. That's funny, but that's not funny, okay? I'm serious. Do not make that argument. Do not make that mistake. I'm serious. Do not make that mistake. You need to start from a position of finding a common ground and mutual respect. And don't go after Muhammad. Don't do it. Don't do it. Go for Jesus. Don't go after Muhammad. Same thing with Mormons. I mean, oh my goodness, Joseph Smith. Oh man, I'll tell you. But don't go after Joseph Smith. Don't do it. It's a mistake. It's a bad strategy. So I'm talking purely from a strategical point of view. And I've had arguments with my friends. You know, I believe that Christianity is not purely rational. It's never irrational. Something that's irrational is something which doesn't make sense, that can't be defended rationally. However, I would say the cross is not rational. The cross is about love. It's not about logic. In fact, you read 1 Corinthians 1, and he clearly says, you have a discussion with the philosophers, and you may not even win that discussion. That's because their hearts are bad. So that's my answer to your question. Okay? I'll take one or two more questions, and then we'll do a break, and we'll start the next session. Yeah?
So you were talking about morals and ethics. So
yeah.
I appreciate you making that distinction. And what do you say to the atheist who says, obviously the Bible's not true, and so how do you come to a standard of right and wrong? This is throughout history, throughout, people have, over time developed right and wrongs, and of course you got to go through the system. Okay, well, how did they come to that? But just, what was accepted culturally as right and wrong is sort of really how we come to our standards today.
Right, so basically, atheists or naturalists have to explain why it is that everybody believes in right and wrong. And so they have to come up with an evolutionary explanation. I would just say, that's a lousy explanation. It really is a lousy explanation. And I believe those explanations are the result of circular reasoning. In other words, one they know for sure is there's no moral truth. That much they know. So now what we have to do is we have to figure out how we're going to explain the fact that everybody believes in it, even though it's not real. So they have to come up with evolutionary explanations. And these explanations are very, very weak. They're very weak. So they'll say, they'll use arguments, like bees. And, bees have to the worker bees have to take care of the mother bees. Because if they don't, all this kind of stuff. And I believe that's just, what can I say? I believe that's a weak argument. But That's they're forced to make those arguments. I just think they're very weak. They tend to become pseudoscience, and they start, you know, what's his name? God delusion. He starts making up the idea of a meme. What's a meme? And even cultural anthropologists say, what's he talking about? So in order for scientists to kind of find the way to have evolution create morality and all this sort of stuff, I think they just do, it's a bunch of pseudoscience, to be honest with you. So it's just a weak argument. What can I say? Yeah, but thank you, at least they have one. It's better than not having one, I guess. It's just a weak one. Okay? Yeah.
So you're talking about the existence of God. Last year I studied with a guy from China who almost had no concept of God.
Sure.
And what would you suggest kind of the best, because that, I guess, growing up in America.
Right. The arguments we have here doesn't say a whole lot about God. It really doesn't. And let's not make an argument say more than it does or prove more than it does.
Right. And so what would be your approach to just explaining a concept of a deity form?
Well, what I would do, it depends on the person. Like I said, 90-something percent of people, these arguments aren't going to... But you just mentioned a person who this is the kind of argument you may actually have to do. It's great. So what you've established at this point, like my friend, this formerly atheist professor guy, co-teacher, he realizes the universe is not an accident. Okay?
Amen.
Not this one. You know, as if he's that guy. This guy is old and bald.
Amen.
So anyway, so you've established with somebody that the universe is not an accident. All right? Well, then, don't assume Christianity at this point. Right, your Chinese friend comes from a country where there's more Buddhists than there are Christians, and there's more atheists than either of those combined. All right, so then you start doing a worldview argument, which we're going to do that later on. So because really, using these arguments that I've established, it leads you to what's called classically deism, not theism. And so we need other things to argue for theism as opposed to deism. Anthony Flew was the most well-known atheist in the middle part of the 20th century into the late 20th century, and he had many debates with Church of Christ guys, actually, very famous, and he accepted the theological argument in his 80s, and he said, there's a God, there's obviously a God. He didn't accept Christianity. So for somebody like him, he might have to start talking about Jesus. And so for your Chinese friend, let's say your Chinese friend has had this awakening. Wow, it's not an accident. Well, then that means there's a purpose. Hmm. Well, it's not unreasonable to think that if there is a creator and a God who created us for a reason, then he's found ways to communicate with us. That's a reasonable premise. So at the very least, he should start investigating religion. And then hopefully using some of the things we'll talk about later on tomorrow, we can talk about pantheism, we can talk about polytheism and dualism and all these other possible ways of thinking about the universe, assuming there is some kind of supernatural. And I think you would end up with theism. All right, and then at that point we start talking about the biblical perspective. Anyway, at some point you're going to have to get the person into the Bible, but possibly your Chinese friend, you might want to lay a little bit more basis. Of course, it never hurts if he's willing to read the Bible, anytime they read it, just go for it. But if somebody is asking these most basic questions, that's what Paul did in Acts 17. He says, your concept of God, I want to give you a different concept. Your concept of God is that God is very, very, very distant. That's deism or pantheism or something like that. And he says, I want to present you the idea of a God who's near. Right? Isn't that what he says? Mm-hmm. In him we live and move and have our being. And he set the time. He says, that I want to present that concept of God to you. What do you think about that? That's what he did. That's what I would do with my Chinese friend. Okay, one more, yeah.
Just kind of a quick comment on his, too. I studied the Bible with a guy. China that kind of at the end of the semester, he ended up going home, and we plugged him into the church there, and he eventually got baptized.
Awesome.
But one of the things that really helped was investing in a Chinese English Bible. Kind of side by side.
Mm-hmm.
You can find that, you know, on eBay for $20 or something. But for them to be able to actually read it in Chinese, because of the sentence structure, everything, however it is, it just started to click so much more when he was able to read it. You know, and then we talked about all the things that he did there to just go after the basic common sense of, you know, stuff as an enactment.
Now let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll have we'll have two sessions before lunch apparently, and then we'll have either two or three after lunch. So, great. 10-minute break. All right.